Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to the Atlanta Legal Experts radio show. I am your host, Emily Rowell with AttorneyOfficeSpace.com. We also have Rich Casanova here. He's our producer with Business Radio X.
Welcome, Emily. How are you this morning?
Very good.
Are you ready for the weekend already? I heard you saying that earlier. Yeah. Oh, we have a great studio lineup this morning. Yes. I'm excited to hear what's going on in the legal industry here in Atlanta.
Yes, we have the a lot of members of the GTLA, which is the Georgia Trial Lawyers Association. We have Jennifer Ivey with the Lindley Jones Firm.
Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. How are y'all?
Great. How are you doing this morning?
Good. Mia Frieder with Hilly and Frieder?
Hilly and Frieder.
Michael Priato with Slaver, Priato, Marugliano, and Holbert.
Close.
Thank you.
See, now you're covered. If anything goes wrong, that was the other guy or whatever. Yeah.
Plausible deniability always.
I knew you had a legal term for that, yeah.
John Bay with Bay & Associates. That one was easy.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. And Jennifer Auer-Jordan with the Jordan Firm.
Good morning. Thank you. You got it right.
Yay, I got one right. Thank you. All of the attorneys, like I said, are the members of the GTLA. We're going to start with all of them actually discussing the recent partnership, very recent partnership with kidsandcars.org to petition the White House to prevent child heat stroke deaths in vehicles. So let's just jump right in, I think, and go ahead. Jennifer, if you'd like to get started with that.
Sure. We are interested in partnering to try and get signatures for this petition so that hopefully the White House and legislators will try and put some pressure on these car manufacturers to get this technology into cars that will alert people to the fact that there's a child still in their car. And the technology already exists. This is not innovative. This is not new. This is not something that is going to be a stretch for these auto manufacturers to do. And we just feel like it's important, you know, if we can prevent any deaths of any kids that are left in any cars, we'd like to see that done.
I'm surprised it hasn't started already.
Well, what is that technology? Is it based on movement in the car, or it just can't be weight in the seat or anything, or we don't know, but it does. It's out there. We're going to do our tech show next week, whatever. Yeah.
They have cooling mechanisms, though. There is cooling mechanism technology available that can keep the car at a cooler temperature. They've litigated these issues for really over 10 years, especially when you have like a daycare van or a van that's used to transport children. When it's not just a parent who, you know, sometimes people say that, how can you forget a child? But it's not always a parent. It can be a daycare worker where it isn't their own child and someone falls asleep. And there is a way to keep those temperatures cooler so that a child doesn't have to suffer. It's a really tragic, horrible, pointless death when something like this happens. So it is out there and it is not that expensive.
So when did this all come about as far as your partnership with the kidsandcars.org?
Yesterday, this is hot breaking news here at the Georgia Trailers Association.
Awesome. Awesome. Okay, well, good. Well, we'll probably focus a little more on that as we go along. And Jennifer, I'm going to start with you. Welcome again. I will just tell a quick bio about Jennifer Ivey. She grew up in Georgia, went to Lassiter High School, UGA, for undergrad, and Georgia State for law school. Enjoys representing people who have been hurt either physically or by their lawyers, practices, personal injury, and legal malpractice. Involved in GSU Law Alumni Association, coaches high school mock trial for the Weber School, volunteers in community at Buckhead Church in the preschool department, and involved in several committees for the Georgia Trial Lawyers Association, currently the chair of the new Lawyers Division, selected for the inaugural lead class of GTLA, which is a leadership academy of GTLA that began last year. Wonderful. So the one thing that, of course, I'm going to ask you is, what is the purpose of the new Lawyers Division of the GTLA?
Well, anyone in GTLA who is either under 35 or has been practicing for 10 years or less is automatically enrolled, if you will, in the New Lawyers Division. And the entire purpose of the New Lawyers Division is to kind of assemble our newer lawyers and help equip and educate them to be better lawyers and have a better long-lasting career and representing their clients to the best of their abilities. So we have programs like Lunch and Learns, where we all get together and we have somebody come in and talk about a discrete topic for a day. We also have social events and networking events to try and encourage these newer lawyers to get to know more experienced lawyers and get contacts with more experienced lawyers.
Thank you. And do you have anything upcoming?
We do, as a matter of fact. On Wednesday, we will be going to see the Brookhaven Bucks baseball team play. This is just a social outing. Anybody can come and bring their picnic and hang out and watch the Brookhaven Bucks. They're actually a collegiate wooden baseball bat team. They're top in their Sun Belt League. They're great. They beat the floor with their competitor on Saturday, so we're looking forward to that matchup.
Are they paying you for that endorsement? That was pretty.
Nah, they're a nonprofit.
That was good stuff. I'm in. I'm not even an attorney. Whatever.
Yeah, yeah, it's fun for everybody. Yeah, you guys are welcome to come too.
Cool.
So, just a quick question to you, also: how many new lawyers do you see go directly into their own private practice?
There's a significant number of new lawyers in GTLA who are going right into their own practice, which is all the more reason to have a new lawyers division mm-hmm. to provide them with support. One of the great things we have at GTLA is a listserv, and it's an email communication network for all of our members. And we see new lawyers utilize that so much to pass information back and forth, to ask for suggestions, ask for help, to ask for documents and assistance with things that people have done a million times before them.
Gotcha. Well, that's wonderful to hear. I love to hear that. And just a little bit about your practice. Tell me, what is legal malpractice?
Legal malpractice refers to the area of law that we practice where we basically sue lawyers who mess stuff up. Just like there are lawyers who sue doctors and architects and all kinds of everyday people as well, lawyers can be held responsible too for their errors and omissions in their professional environment.
Is that one of the main things that the Lindley Jones firm practices?
Yes, yes. And my boss, Lindley, has kind of created a niche in that area and paved the way for that area of law. It's an emerging area of law. Some things are not totally fleshed out in legal malpractice, so it's always developing and always interesting.
Gotcha. I bet it is. And so you've kind of gotten a little passionate about it as well, just from, you know, all the cases that she's had and you've had, I'm sure.
Absolutely. I didn't necessarily go to law school and say, man, I want to sue all my friends. but once I started doing it, I realized that it really matches with the ethic of being a plaintiff's lawyer, you know, representing people who've been hurt. They've just been hurt in a different way and they need help and lawyers need to be held accountable in just the same way that everybody else is.
That makes a good point. What are some of the common mistakes that lawyers make?
Lawyers will miss deadlines. That's something that happens, unfortunately, frequently, whether it's a statute of limitation or it's a renewal deadline. Unfortunately, lawyers do miss deadlines. That's one of the most common things that we see. They also sometimes mess up on releases. When you're agreeing to release a party of an obligation, you have to make sure that you're releasing the right party and not too much of the substantive area that you're releasing.
Okay. And do, like you said, you didn't want to upset all your friends. What do they feel about that when you're out there suing other attorneys?
Well, of course, it does ruffle some people's feathers sometimes. But for the most part, lawyers are very justice-minded. And lawyers built their whole career on the understanding that everybody deserves representation, no matter if it is the biggest corporation or the smallest individual. So I have a lot of support among my peer group, especially to fight for and advocate for justice.
Fantastic. Well, it sounds like you guys do a wonderful job. And so just tell me really quickly how our listeners can get in touch with you.
Well, if you go to lindleyjones.com, you can check out our website and see all of the work that we've done for citizens here across the state of Georgia.
Thank you. And thank you for being here. And feel free to pitch in, too. You're not done yet.
No pun intended on the pitch in or whatever. Yeah.
So here we're going to come to Mia Frieder with Frieder and, I'm sorry, Hilly and Frieder. And Mia Frieda represents individuals injured through the negligence of others, sort of like a little bit about what Jennifer does. She practices with her husband, Ron Hilly, and focuses on auto/truck collisions, slip and fall injuries, medical malpractice, and workers' comp. She's a member of the multi-million-dollar and million-dollar advocates forum. She's AV rated 5/5, which is the highest rating available from Martindale Hubbell, and has published nationally on failure to diagnose breast cancer and other negligence-related topics. She is the current chair of the Women's Trial Lawyer Caucus of the Georgia Trial Lawyers Association and a member of the editorial board for Verdict, the GTLA publication. She has two children, Blake and Ilana.
That's correct.
Aged 14 and 10, and two dogs, Spike and Snoopy.
That's about it.
Well, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So a little bit about the GTLA, since we are here representing the GTLA. Tell me more about the Chair of Women Trial Lawyer Caucus.
Sorry. Well, I'm very proud to be the chair. It's a great organization. We have about 200 members. I believe there's a little over 1,000 members in GTLA. They're all trial lawyers representing injured plaintiffs, mm-hmm. and about 200 of them are automatically, they're all women, and they're automatically a member. And it's really a group that we just get together, and in a way it dovetails to what Jen was talking about with the new lawyers division, because it will provide a mentoring group for new lawyers. And it will also it allows people to get together informally and share information. And I think it makes us all better lawyers.
So is this a recent accomplishment being chair?
It is. It just started. And I think it's only our second year that we've actually had a Women's Trial Lawyer Caucus. So
Fantastic.
It's very exciting. And then with Lindley being president.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really exciting time, I think, for women in terms of being trial lawyers, because we've been traditionally, I think, underrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of odd because there's studies that'll show that people, even jurors, actually prefer their, like, perfect idea of a trial lawyer is like a teacher. And most mm-hmm. of them have in mind a woman, I guess,
right.
because we've had more women teachers. And
right.
so it's kind of odd, I think, that we're so late coming to this, and yet we are so welcomed by the
right.
people that we're pitching our stories to.
And I'm sure it'll grow very quickly.
I hope so.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more on the GTLA. The plaintiff's personal injury lawyers come under a lot of attack, but also do a lot of good to promote safer products and practices. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I think that the plaintiff's lawyers, we perform a certain watchdog function in the community.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of products are safer because of trial lawyers, cars and seat belts and toys and the wonderful work they're doing now with the partnership about, you know, hot cars
mm-hmm.
and children. And so I think it's we perform a kind of a necessary evil. Sometimes we come under attack, but in the long run, the good we do.
Mm-hmm.
And even like with medical malpractice, there was a recent article. Well, not that recent, but like in the Wall Street Journal, they did a piece in 2010, which
mm-hmm.
focused on how medical malpractice attorneys were actually helping make hospitals safer,
mm-hmm.
and that hospitals were looking at the the different types of cases in terms of making safer procedures. So sometimes we come under attack that we make insurance rates higher, but we also make it much safer in the long run. So that I
sure.
think the good always outweighs.
Fantastic. Let me tell me about the impact of social media and how it plays informal surveillance for the plaintiffs.
Well, all of the clients I represent are injured. And one of the things that is very interesting is that so many of my clients like to post on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
and we're just not aware of how much information we put out about ourselves, and that
right.
it's not always used by people that are friends, but
and it never goes away.
It doesn't go away. And
that's a good point.
This is especially, it's really prominent in the workers' compensation arena, where a lot of the defense attorneys or the insurance companies will hire surveillance, and they
mm-hmm.
will they will hire someone to follow someone who's injured and see what they're doing. And now sometimes they don't mean to do it, but people post so much about their own life that they're actually helping, you know, they're actually doing their own informal surveillance, and it's become a huge reservoir of information to go to. So it's just a different facet of it that we see in our practice. And I mean, it, certainly there's other ramifications, but it's one thing that's become a real, what they actually term informal surveillance. It's used a lot now.
I've actually heard about somebody that was just leaving, taking a leave from work, and actually went to another state for an interview and posted it online, and his job found out about it, and he was immediately fired.
Well, they do all those postings in Foursquare, but what's the one where you can post, sign in where you're at and so forth. But are there boundaries on legalities of, just as a listener observer, I'm just wondering as a citizen, like, is that all content available and can be used against you, as they say?
Well, it's discoverable.
It's fair game.
I mean, it's discoverable. Yeah. I mean,
because
I actually get
stuff on the internet.
They actually send with directions now how to, I mean, I've gotten discovery requests that'll give directions how to download the Facebook pages. I mean, they actually tell you how to go about getting it.
Wow.
So, I mean, I don't know how they're going to work on it. I've never had to challenge the admissibility yet, but it's certainly discoverable.
And it's somewhat of a two-edged sword because we use that as a tool as well. I know that in my firm, we don't go to take depositions of witnesses without first pulling their social media page, particularly if they're not secured. And we find out a tremendous amount of information. And it's been wonderful when we've been involved in depositions where they've communicated with their coworkers about what had happened in their deposition they weren't supposed to. We found that they've said nasty stuff about us or our clients, and it's just wonderful to be able to utilize that information to cross-examine them during their deposition.
I mean, it used to just be phone calls or text, but now it's like it's...
I would never have survived.
Yeah, yeah.
and I think the most pertinent part of that is what was said earlier. It never goes away.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you really got to watch what you're putting out there. One of the things that I always think about when we go on vacation, I don't ever put anything out there until I come back, because you're telling everybody out there that you're not home. You know, so that's, I see people on vacation, they're posting all their stuff, and I'm here and I'm there, and I'm like, I'm excited for them, but wait till you get back.
We know where you're not.
It's not even what you post, too. I mean, it's also what, you know, your friends or your, like you said, even like colleagues are posting about what occurs. It goes beyond just what you're putting up.
Right, right. Well, thank you for that. That's huge. What about your practice a little bit? What do you focus on in your practice?
We do all injury work. I practice with my husband, which is in itself a minor miracle, but all of the work is focused on people that are injured. And we do, you know, all types of injuries, whether it's on the job or off the job, car wrecks and medical malpractice and slip and falls.
I'd like to hear a little more about the medical malpractice. Failure to diagnose breast cancer is still one of the most commonly litigated claims, according to you, of medical negligence, even with the campaign of early detection. Can you tell me more about that?
Well, the campaign for early detection is great. I mean, I didn't mean it to be negative on that score, but it's just that failure to diagnose is still the most litigated medical malpractice claim. I think it's 40% of all malpractice claims involve some failure to diagnose. And of that, I believe since 1995, failure to diagnose breast cancer has probably been in the forefront. It's very oftentimes, it's just very difficult. It doesn't have the very easily identifiable risk factors that you do with some other types of illnesses.
Sure.
And the group of people that it's hard to diagnose and are young. Mm-hmm. So women that you wouldn't usually would suspect of some type of terminal disease.
Right.
But with all the early detection, I think it does make people much more aware of it. And that has changed over the time.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for being on the show again. And again, you're not done yet. No, I'm just kidding. So tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you.
We have a website, hillylaw.com. Or they can just contact me directly, which is, I'm on Facebook and LinkedIn, and there's a link on the website, or they can just contact me at miafrieder@hillylaw.com. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. And I'm not even going to try. No, I know it's Prieto.
There you go. That's it.
However, the name of your company?
It's Slover, Prieto, Marigliano, and Holbert. We are a testament to being diverse.
And you also make my job very good. Very tough. Michael Prieto founded the firm's nursing home wrongful death practice and has developed it into one of the largest long-term care plaintiffs practices in Georgia, recovering millions of dollars for clients in the process. His litigation work focuses on representing patients and families against assisted living, skilled nursing, acute, subacute, and long-term care facilities. He advocates for fair compensation when wrongful acts and omissions are discovered, and through aggressive efforts tries to assure that the same thing will never happen to another innocent victim. He has appeared on numerous television programs, so your job is better than mine, including Larry King, Oprah, Paul Lazon, Today, Good Morning America, Donahue, and others. He has been quoted by the Los Angeles Times and other print media. Mr. Prieto serves as county administrator in Bartow County, as well as probate judge pro tempore. He has also served in the U.S. Army Judge Advocate General Corps and is a combat veteran of wars in the Middle East. He is an active member of the American Association for Justice and the GTLA. He is a member of the AAJ Nursing Home Litigation Group and chair of the GTLA Nursing Home Litigation Group.
Gosh, you make me sound better.
I really like that. Keep going. There was hardly anything I could cut out because it was all so impressive.
Yeah. I had no idea, Mike. I'm learning so much today.
Well, thanks for being here. So tell me more about the nursing home abuse and neglect.
Well, you know, the nursing home industry is the second most highly regulated industry in the entire world, second only to nuclear energy, which is kind of a scary thing when you think of it.
Wow.
And when you consider that right now in the state of Georgia, 3 out of 5 people in this room will spend time in a subacute facility, which is a traditional nursing home, excuse me, for at least rehabilitative care within their life. Mm. And I'm sorry. And right now in the U.S., there were 1.5 million reports of abuse and neglect in a nursing home last year alone. And the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services say that only about 20% of instances of abuse and neglect are actually reported.
Oh, wow.
So as our baby boomers continue to age, we've got a catastrophic problem on our hands. And while the reimbursement rates, which is how nursing homes are reimbursed by the federal government, continue to go down, and the cost of everything continues to go up, we're kind of, our backs are in a corner. So if we don't do something now to address the way that our elderly are being treated, we're all going to pay the price.
So that's what you focus your practice on.
I do. It's kind of an odd practice because it's so regulatory intense, and it's Med-Mal on steroids is what I call it.
Okay.
Because we have traditional medical negligence issues, but we also have the Omnibus Reconciliation Act of 1987, which was legislation that was designed to create a minimum standard for care and treatment of residents in a skilled nursing facility. So we actually have the benefit of not just what testifying experts would tell us about the standard of care. We also have actually codified, look it up in the Code of Federal Regulations as to what the standard of care is.
Wow. So tell me one of the most rewarding parts of your job.
You know, the first time I ever had a nursing home case was, in nursing home cases, it's somewhat simple. It was an elderly lady who was at a facility and she developed a pressure sore. And a pressure sore, a lot of people call them bed sores. And, you know, lots of folks think that they're just common and that they're unavoidable, but they're not. I mean, they're really just attributable to pressure, hydration, and nutrition. Well, she wasn't properly repositioned and turned every 2 hours. She developed a pressure sore on her heel, and she had to have her leg amputated.
Oh, no.
Which, you know, sounds horrific, and it truly, truly was. She was the spunkiest, meanest lady I've ever met, and I loved her from the moment I met her. She was somewhat demented, and her daughter was 77, and her mother was in her 90s and still had it. And all she wanted was to be able to die at home. And we were able to resolve the case very early in the litigation, and have enough money that she could go home and have skilled nursing care at home, and she was able to pass at home. And it was a heartwarming experience for me.
And one of your first cases, you
said? It was my very first case.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was great.
That is very rewarding. You're like, I think I picked the right path.
Well, I think most lawyers would agree that if that your practice area finds you eventually. You can hide from it, but eventually you come full circle.
Yeah. Kind of like Jennifer was saying about suing other lawyers.
I've come full circle to sue other lawyers. Great.
Well, you know, Emily, one of the things
that's on your website, isn't it? Your slogan. Yeah.
You know, one of the things about suing other lawyers, though, is that the legal profession is the only profession that polices itself.
Sure.
I mean, our ethical obligations are so stringent that if we make a mistake, we have an affirmative obligation to go to our client and say, we've messed up. You need to go find a lawyer. We now have a conflict of interest so that you can bring a claim against me. And a failure to do that is a violation of our ethical obligations.
Sure.
So there aren't a lot of professions out there that have such stringent regulations.
And it sounds
you don't get that from your mechanic, right? I didn't fix your car right, so I'm going to send you to another mechanic and I'll pay the bill or whatever. Yeah.
You don't get that from your physician either.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really important. We always come around to the doctors here, too.
Oh, okay. I didn't make that note. I had a question. Obviously, you come in many times, imagine, after the fact, you know, when an incident or, you know, an issue has been raised. But is there a way, you know, some tips you could leave our listeners for those folks that have maybe family members in those homes, a preventive? I mean, what's the red flags or what to look out for? Or what could they, you know, what's not to say one home versus another home, but what are some indicators that there might be some issues?
That's a great question. It's somewhat multifaceted. Yeah, I'll try to address them. Okay. But I think the first thing is that when you're looking for a skilled nursing facility, you can do research online, and Medicare.gov actually has a 5-star rating system that you can utilize to determine the staffing quotas, the quality of care, their skilled nursing hours versus just CNA hours. And that's your first step. The second thing is go to the facility. If you walk in and there's a strong odor of urine and feces, then it's somewhat of an indication that maybe they're not cleaning the way they should.
And but if they're not doing that, they're probably not extending the care beyond to those folks there.
Absolutely, because it really just shows that there's a lack of staffing. And that's your big issue in these facilities. I actually worked at a nursing home.
Wow.
I did it in college, and it was the hardest, worst job I've ever had in my entire life. I think that some people are meant to do it, and some people are not. And it can be very rewarding. And the facility that I worked for was a horrible facility, and I actually sued that facility. And the owner is now in a federal prison for abusing the elderly as a result of our lawsuit. Well, and it's the first time ever that a nursing home owner has been prosecuted for Medicare and Medicaid fraud.
That's an amazing story. Yeah. I don't know if we have time or whatever, if you can, but the issue of like Alzheimer's or, you know, believability issue, right? Because it's kind of, they said against, you know, the establishment. So do you run into that with folks that are in there? And it's like, well, they're complaining, but is it real? Or, I mean, how do you?
I do, and I really want to go back and just answer your previous question quickly because I think it's important. One of the biggest things is going to see the facility. The second thing is when you do put your loved one into a facility, it should be a facility that is relatively close, because being part of your loved one's life on a continuing basis does more to ensure that they receive good care than anything else in the world, because they know that you're watching.
That's the thing. The staff knows that you're in there, you know, on a moment's notice. Yeah,
that's right. And the other thing is that a lot of people choose to come every Wednesday night or every Sunday afternoon, and you shouldn't. You should mix it up so that no one knows when you're coming. And that's when you'll see if there's any signs of any type of abuse or neglect. But some of the standard things to see are unexplained bruising, being kind of head shy when you reach out to touch someone and they pull back, and just listening, because someone's demented doesn't mean that you can't obtain some information from them. The biggest takeaway from anything that I say today is that if you have a friend or family member who's at one of these facilities, go see them, be part of their life, because their life's not over the moment that they check into a facility.
Sure. Well, thank you so much. And it sounds like you really care about your clients, and we're excited to have you here. So tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you.
Well, they can reach us at our website at www.spmhlaw. And our telephone number is 404-856-0040.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Over to you, John. You didn't know you were the other co-host. John Bay, thank you for coming, Bay & Associates.
Yes, thanks for having me.
He is the managing partner of Bay & Associates. Mr. Bay specializes in serious personal injury, complex civil litigation, and criminal defense. Mr. Bay has been involved in the recovery of millions of dollars for deserving individuals and families. His aggressive and zealous advocacy has resulted in successful pretrial resolution of a number of disputes. During this time, Mr. Bay has dedicated himself to advocacy for those who have been victimized by serious injuries. Prior to commencing his career in private practice, Mr. Bay graduated from the University of Cincinnati and earned his JD from the University of Alabama School of Law. Mr. Bay also held positions in the legal department of Procter & Gamble and General Electric Legal Operations and served as a legal intern in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals under the Honorable Nathaniel R. Jones. He has also worked in litigation of several prestigious law firms in Atlanta and Birmingham. As dedicated as Mr. Bay is to defending and protecting the rights of victims of injustice, he is also committed to serving the community. He's also a member of several professional and civic organizations, including the American Bar, the National Bar, the American Association for Justice, the GTLA, of course, and the Farrow Law Society and Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated. Thank you. And you can also hear the rest of his bio and see the rest of his bio and all the guests we have today on our website. Tell me a little bit about your practice and more about what you focus on.
Sure. Well, I focus on helping people who've been hurt by the negligence of someone else. And it's really kind of a mixed bag, including auto torts, which would include your simple car wreck to mm-hmm. your trucking accident, as well as medical malpractice. I'm kind of all over the place.
Gotcha. So tell me about arbitration.
Sure. Well, first of all, arbitration is a great system when it's consensual and both parties decide that they want to enter into arbitration. The issue that I think a lot of consumers would be interested in would be when it's forced arbitration. Okay. And that's those arbitration agreements that are stuck into the bottom, you know, in the small print of your contracts, or when you click on and accept your iTunes, or you get a new cell phone. So I think that a lot of people would be interested in when that forced arbitration agreement is there, you're kind of giving away your rights to a jury trial. You are, in fact. So one thing to consider when you're looking at those arbitration agreements is that arbitration agreement there? Are you agreeing to an arbitrator right off the bat? If so, who is that arbitrator? Is it somebody who's normally employed by that business? Is that their number one client? If so, it might be difficult for you to be able to get a fair shake in that situation.
So to the layman, to whoever is listening, tell me, define arbitration just so that we can understand exactly what people can look for.
Sure. So, you'll be able to see that it says arbitration, but arbitration is a system where there's an arbitrator who makes a final ruling. So you don't go before a judge, you don't go before a jury. There's a person who's selected and they make a final ruling on your case and how everything will be decided.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Thank you. That was actually me. I was the one that was the general listener.
You were wondering, yeah.
And I should know that by now after interviewing all these attorneys. What should I do if a contract includes a forced arbitration agreement?
Sure. Well, I would talk. I mean, the number one thing to do is to talk to the person who you're signing the contract with and explain to them that, you know, if you want to keep arbitration open as an avenue, then tell them that you want to have, you know, you all decide on who the arbitrator is after whatever happens. Because a lot of times when you're starting at the beginning of a contract, you don't know what could go wrong and you don't know what rights you may be giving away. Mm-hmm. So you want to have that conversation about whether or not, you know, what is going to happen on the back end and who that arbitrator will be, and if you even really want to go to arbitration. My personal stance on it would be that you probably want to keep your rights open. You want to make sure that if necessary, you're able to have a jury of your peers, you know, your Seventh Amendment right protected, and you're able to go to trial.
If I could just add one thing, is that we see arbitration agreements that are snuck into nursing home agreements on a daily basis. And as John said, that if arbitration is such a great thing, then it should be an agreement to arbitrate post-dispute rather than a pre-dispute arbitration. And they're somewhat hidden in language. They could be called alternative dispute resolution agreement or arbitration agreement. And if someone's being admitted to a nursing home, it is a violation of the OBRA regulations to say that the execution of the arbitration agreement is a condition of admission. It can't be done. So when someone's being checked in a nursing home, they should certainly read those documents, and they should opt not to sign the arbitration agreement, because your Seventh Amendment right is so important. I mean, when you think about it, it was something that was so important that our founding fathers listed it in the Constitution for any amount over $20, because it is the only basis in which an individual who is of little or no means can stand on equal footing with the largest corporation in the world. And that's something that's very special about our country.
Right. How has the civil justice system made cars safer for the public?
Sure. Well, one way of making cars more safe for the general public is that there's a system so that people can sue when something goes wrong. And a lot of times when there's a car defect, it's something that could have been resolved for as little as $10 for a part that would make something more safe. For example, recently GM admitted that the seats costing just $1 could have reduced injuries by up to 90%.
Wow.
So it's important that, you know, people are able to bring these claims against car manufacturers so that we're making the general public and the general car more safe. Because if not, then people who are making cars would be able to put profits over people.
Right, right. Wow. That's just so important. And you would think nowadays with the technology that we have that they would be as safe as they possibly could be, you know. But obviously there are always flaws. And they always have a recall. Every time I go, oh, you have a recall in your car. Thanks. So that's awesome that you guys kind of keep them in check.
Absolutely.
One of the things is that what lawsuits also do is it makes the general public aware of problems. And I think we've seen that with GM.
You're gonna need to lean, a little closer to the mic.
I think we've seen that with General Motors, which is, you know, you start to see the same problems over and over and over in the same lawsuits filed over and over and over. Mm-hmm. The public becomes aware, and then there's pressure put on the corporations.
Sure.
And so in some ways, the civil justice system helps us regulate ourselves and not have to have the government come in and do regulations, because really it is the marketplace that's putting pressure on the corporations to make products safer.
Capitalism at its best.
Thank you.
Didn't the issue with the ignition switch originated here in Atlanta, I believe, right? On all the recall that took place.
Absolutely, a member of Georgia Trial Lawyers Association, former president Lance Cooper.
And that's gone across the entire U.S. or whatever. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you know the outcome of that, but I mean, it's pretty substantial, right?
Oh, it's still pending, right?
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, it's the same question. How has the civil justice system actually made toys safer for the public?
Sure. Well, I mean, just right off the bat, 196 children died from choking on toy parts and small balloons last year.
Still?
We're in 2014. We're talking about 2013. It's just another way that we're able to regulate the toy products that are going out there. And we all remember the lead scares and all the different things that happened a few years ago. Mm-hmm. We also had the collapsing, I believe it was 07, we had the collapsing cribs. But these are always a way that we're able to then in turn go back to the manufacturers and make them come out with a safer product. And as a result, year after year, we get safer car seats, we get safer cribs, and we get safer toys for our children. And as somebody with a 2.5-year-old and one on the way in September, I'm particularly interested in making sure that the toys are safer for our little ones.
And they've actually made a little lead testing kit now, right? Where you can actually test the toys that you've had for a long time or whatever. So
yes,
absolutely. And that's duty. The civil justice system.
The trial. I can't take credit for that one.
But they're not here. Go ahead.
And then healthcare, the last question, and probably could be a long conversation, but to
it's a whole radio show.
I know, exactly. Exactly.
Sure. Right. Well, we got new statistics on healthcare, and we know that, you know, as many as 440,000 people die every year in hospitals by preventable medical errors. Now, that's not to say that all doctors are bad. In fact, only five, you know, we find that more than half of all instances of medical negligence are caused by only 5% of doctors. Oh, but wow. those 5% that are causing medical errors, and the things that are genuinely preventable medical errors, are things that need to come to the surface. And it really kind of helps to police that industry. Again, like as Mike was saying earlier, doctors aren't self-reporting. They're not. It's not the same. So there has to be something there that that polices them and helps our healthcare system to be safer. And I like to think that we do our part as trial lawyers to do that.
To pick up on something you'd asked earlier, I don't know if people are aware of it, but you know they can go to the composite board and they can look up their doctor. They can see if there's a certain judgments reported when they're over a certain amount. So people right. can go and look, and just because, I mean, it's just good information to have available. So if you're looking at a new physician, it's just one place to look. It's public information that's out there.
It kind of reminds me of that TV commercial. It's been maybe a while back, but where the person's like, they go into their cell phone company, and they ask like 97 questions about all the features on their cell phone. They go into the doctor and say, any question? No. You know, I think they're, I don't know where the disconnect is there or whatever, right? It's like, I just think that...
It's out there, though. People can find it. What I find hard, and I think most people that do medical negligence is that, you know, doctors, they don't really mean to do harm. I mean, they take an mm-hmm. oath.
Well, like you said, it's only 5%, but you multiply that across the entire U.S. It's kind of like UPS and FedEx. They say, you know, if they operate at 99.9%, there's still the ripple effect of all the packages that are not delivered and all the issues. They have to be at 100%. You know, and now we're dealing with people's lives, not just, you know,
stuff.
Not only are physicians in Georgia not obligated to self-report, I mean, the pendulum has swung so far in the opposite direction. If a surgeon makes a mistake and is supposed to amputate a right leg and amputates the left leg, and they come to the family member and say, I'm so sorry, I operated on the wrong leg, and admits it. In the state of Georgia, that's not admissible in a trial.
Wow.
They can still go into a courtroom and say, I did nothing wrong. So to me, it's a matter of integrity.
Right.
And you know, you hear a lot about defensive medicine and defensive practice. But if the medical profession and all manufacturers would literally just take responsibility for their own actions, if you mess up, you know— integrity demands that you say, gosh, I messed up, and don't worry, we're going to make it right. Mm-hmm. And that's what really drives up the cost of litigation. And we see it on both as when I was a defense lawyer as well as now as a plaintiff's lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Medical negligence is expensive, though, which you'd have to agree.
It's
and
it's
that's one of the
expensive.
Things that they use to stop a plaintiff from bringing a case. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that they actually actively choose that prevents people from bringing a case, because you can't bring a case and do justice for your client.
Well, thank you, John Bay, and tell me a little bit more on how people can get in touch with you and if they need to call your firm.
Sure, people can get in touch with me at www.bayandassociates, and Bay is spelled B-E-Y, and telephone number to the office is 404-344-4448.
Thank you. And we'll have to have everybody back because all these conversations, we could have like one subject per show,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And I think you guys just do such a great job. Jennifer, yeah. I'm so glad you guys were first and last.
Right. Full circle again.
Yeah. For our listening audience, this is a different Jennifer or whatever. Yeah. Right.
It's Jennifer Auer Jordan, and she specializes in complex civil cases like business disputes, investment fraud, whistleblower actions, and consumer class actions. Her work in the courtroom has resulted in a number of impressive verdicts and settlements, including a multi-million-dollar award to Georgia consumers victimized by unfair lending practices. She has represented thousands of Georgia consumers in multiple class action lawsuits against payday lenders. Jennifer graduated magna cum laude from the University of Georgia Law School of Law, where she was a member of the Georgia Law Review and the school's award-winning National Moot Court team. She currently serves as the president of the UGA Law School Association Council. In 2013, she was named as one of the University of Georgia's 40 Under 40 alumni. This list recognizes prominent graduates that have made an impact in business, leadership, community, educational, and or philanthropic endeavors. They've demonstrated dedication to the University of Georgia and its mission of teaching, research, and service. In 2013, she developed an iPad app called Jury Strike to help other trial lawyers with jury selection. She currently assists other trial attorneys during the jury selection process. She is a frequent speaker on social media issues that arise in the context of litigation. We're excited to have you here.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Now, tell me, can my Facebook page be used against me by my employer in a lawsuit? We kind of talked about that. Tell me more.
Yeah, absolutely it can. I think one of the things, as Bea was talking about, is that folks don't understand that everything that they're putting out there, especially if it's public in terms of your Facebook settings, is accessible to your employer or anybody else who's interested in just finding out about you. Mm-hmm. It's discoverable in litigation, but a lot of times people don't think about kind of pre-litigation things that can happen. What about when you are actually interviewing for a job? A potential employer can look at your Facebook page. They can look at LinkedIn. They can look at Instagram, and they can kind of get an instant read on who you are as a person. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, unfortunately, people overshare and put things that they shouldn't. Or even if they're not doing it, their friends are. Maybe you go out to the bar on a Friday night with a friend who gets a little happy with the their camera. Mm-hmm. And then they post it and tag you on your Facebook page. So sometimes you can even do all, you know, that you can to kind of make sure that you don't put anything inappropriate out there. But sometimes your friends will kind of mess it up for you.
Right, right. That's kind of scary. And well, like you said before, I mean, people just put everything on their Facebook page.
They put everything.
And Twitter.
And yeah.
Twitter. It's like a minute-by-minute update of people's lives. I can't understand why one would want to do that.
Or want to read it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Or who has the time? I just wonder who has the time. I'm just now really starting to get into Twitter a little more than I, just because of the job, you know?
So you tweet?
I do tweet, and I retweet, which is really hard to say a lot.
It's interesting, though.
Just don't do both at the same time. Yeah.
A lot of folks are getting their news from Twitter.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of my Twitter account, it's not that I'm necessarily tweeting, but I am actually going through my feed, and that's how I'm getting my news and what I'm seeing, you know, that's kind of trending and what's popular. And especially for lawyers who do trial work, it's important to kind of be familiar with the trends in technology, because if you're a trial lawyer and you're going in to a courtroom and picking a jury and you're not familiar with the technology that your potential jurors are using, then you're not going to be able to communicate with them appropriately. And especially when you're talking about the millennials. I mean, when they're used to communicating in a way where you only have so many characters or everything is visual, you have to kind of bring that into your technique as a trial lawyer when you're presenting your case.
Yeah, you'd have to relate to the jury, definitely.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So you're saying in jury selection, can they preview all the social media, and is that part of the process in selecting?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I do is we get the jury list almost immediately when we walk in. We send it back to the office, and then the office staff starts doing social media checks on people.
It's weird, we're our own big brother now.
That's what I was just saying.
Right?
George,
I mean,
Lowell.
It's like scary.
Yeah, it's Facebook.
But it's Facebook. And because that used to be, think that was the government and others, you know,
but it's
these
not. It's us.
Watching you. We're like all watching ourselves. It's like, yeah.
But even
it makes it easier for the government.
I'm going to move to an island or whatever. I'm just connecting my Twitter right now. Yeah.
Well, but it's important when you're picking a jury, because Jennifer Ivey could say to me, oh, no, I you know, I'm fair and I'm balanced, whatever the kind of words you use as a jury or a potential juror. And then I get on her Facebook page and she's sitting there posting as she's sitting there talking about how she doesn't like the lawyer that's talking to her, or she really doesn't think that a plaintiff should ever be able to bring a medical malpractice case. And so it's really important to kind of inform
our ability. But I would
never say
that.
Of course you would.
Hypothetical.
Hypothetically.
It's the third Jennifer, not
right.
here today.
Hypothetically. Hypothetically.
Wow, that's incredible. Tell me more about your app.
Well, in terms of the app itself, it doesn't tell you who to pick as a potential juror. A lot of times what trial attorneys have, or attorneys period, who are striking juries, for anybody who's actually been through the jury selection process on one side or the other, it moves very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And the ability to take the information and organize it in a way that's going to let you make the best decisions about who to pick, it's really, really difficult. And so my issue was, how can I take kind of the old school way of drawing boxes and putting information about jurors and mechanize that in a way that can be used by trial lawyers, and especially younger trial lawyers who are familiar and comfortable with using technology in the courtroom? It seemed like a no-brainer to try to put something together. And so that's basically what it does. It helps me organize the information on all the potential jurors so that when it's time for me to strike my jury panel, I know exactly who I want, because I know that Jennifer said this, or Mia said this, or Mike said this, and out of the three of them, who would be best in terms of my case?
Gotcha. And as someone who's one of her customers, we love the app.
I mean,
we've used it in our last two juries. Jury
that's
trials,
awesome.
And it's
Thank
wonderful.
You. Is it
it's
free?
Wonderful.
It's not free, but it's not expensive.
He said he's a customer.
I'm a customer.
Oh, that's right. That's
I'm
right. It's $29.99 on the Apple Store, iTunes. No, but in terms of technology, that's actually not that much.
No.
And especially
well,
if
relative
it makes
to
your
business, too. I mean,
exactly.
If you're selling coffee, it's, you know, different, but yeah.
Well, or if you hire a jury consultant to come in and just sit with you for a few hours. I mean, the investment that you have to put into that. So it's especially for sole practitioners or folks who just have a couple of people in their firms, or even criminal defense lawyers. Some of my biggest customer base are actually criminal defense lawyers and prosecutors, because they're striking juries all the time and they have to be able to do it quickly. And a lot of times it's just going to be one person standing there. And so the app actually helps them do it without having a team of folks.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell me more a little bit about your practice. Just one of the other things that you focus on that you love.
Well, one of the big things, we've talked a lot about personal injury, which is incredibly important in terms of trial lawyer practice generally. I like to say I do money injury. When people have been defrauded, you know, a stockbroker steals $1 million from an elderly lady. It's the kind of stuff where when you actually look at what the injury is, it's not that someone's leg has to be amputated or someone has died. It's that someone has basically been taken advantage of. And that can come in all sorts of claims. It can be just your simple, straightforward consumer claim. I do a lot of, I like to say low-dollar consumer claims that end up in class actions, which kind of the payday lending stuff was part of that, to the high-dollar things where you have small business owners that may have been taken advantage of, and they're trying to seek recourse in the courts to try to get some money back. So I think a lot of folks think about courts as being about car wrecks or medical malpractice, but really there's a different element to it when people just have lost a lot of money, and that can absolutely affect their lives.
Which brings me to my next question. If somebody's a listener involved with a partner in a business deal, the partner refuses to turn over the records dealing with the deal, do I have any recourse?
Well, it always depends on the corporate form, but under Georgia, we have something called the LLC statute, limited liability companies. And under that, there's actually a mechanism where you can go to a judge and force the partner to turn over the records. And so a lot of folks don't think that they have recourse, especially small business people or people who haven't been involved in business before. Mm-hmm. But there's always some recourse under the law generally. Especially if you are in a business situation.
I talk to entrepreneurs and small business owners every single day, and there are a lot of them obviously are brand new in the business world. So that's so important to know, because they don't know who they're getting involved with.
Absolutely.
It could have been their best friend since college or high school, and they realize, you know,
Well, and that's the thing. A lot of times you have subject matter experts who start businesses. We see this a lot with entrepreneurs and technology, folks who are just amazing at what they do in terms of a subject area. And I think this is the issue with lawyers, too, and probably what gets lawyers
in trouble.
I wasn't
going to be the one to say it.
Absolutely.
With legal malpractice. I mean, mm-hmm. but they're not business people, or mm-hmm. they don't understand that maybe you should have a contract with a partner, because why would we ever have any issues? Because we're such great friends. But the issue is when you have a business, on the front end, make sure that the terms are clear so that on the back end, you're protected.
Well, thank you. And tell me a little bit more about how our listeners can get in touch with you, Jennifer.
They can visit www.thejordanfirm.com. And just for purposes of the radio, Jordan is spelled Jordan, J-O-R-D-A-N. So the J-O-R-D-A-N firm.com. And it's the South Georgia pronunciation. So.
Yes. There you go.
You know, Emily, one of the things that you were just discussing a moment ago that I thought was interesting with respect to consumer class actions, and maybe you could tell us what you're seeing with respect to arbitration agreements.
Oh,
because one
horrible.
Of the things that we're seeing right now that I've seen, I serve as the chief of legal assistants for the Georgia Army National Guard now, and I deal with this for service members, where they sign a contract, and then the contract has a provision in that says you will not participate in any class action lawsuit. So it's almost like a license to steal, because if that company that they contract with does something in which the individual is damaged $100, $200, mm-hmm. no one's filing a lawsuit over $200. But
right.
that $200 spread out over 20,000 claims is a substantial amount of money. And the U.S. Supreme Court held last year that those provisions are valid.
Well, one of the things, especially when you're talking about enlisted service people, $200, $300, $400 is a significant amount of money. The issue with the arbitration provisions is now that they've been able to really have the U.S. Supreme Court bless these anti-consumer arbitration clauses is that it basically precludes consumers from being able to get any justice in the courts. And the reason is because what lawyer is going to take a case where ultimately at the end of the day, the result is going to be $200? And what you have on the other end are really big corporations who have the best lawyers in the world fighting against an individual consumer with an individual lawyer over a $200 situation. But that's what we're seeing now in a lot of these consumer cases. And really, it's kind of given them
carte blanche
to do whatever they want to folks. And so I think what we're eventually going to see, Mike, is that there's going to be a pendulum swing back. Hopefully Congress is going to be able to step in one day. I agree with John that when you're talking about consensual business relationships where you have folks who read contracts and know what they're entering into, arbitration can be a good thing because they're on equal footing. But when you're talking about an individual consumer versus big corporation, at the end of the day, really the courts are the only thing that can offer them kind of the equalizing factor.
And yeah, but it's like John said, though, too. It's like you sign off with something online that, you know, just accept agreement online that goes on for, you know, 100 pages. You're not going to read all that, right? And you don't have any recourse is what you're saying once you sign off on that? Or
it's very difficult. Go ahead, John. Yeah. Sorry.
Sure, no, sure. Absolutely. There is no recourse once you sign off on that arbitration agreement. In fact, I just had a client who we had a case where she signed an arbitration agreement and
But online, I mean, just by checking the boxes is what you're talking about,
right?
Or?
Well, online, if you check that box, you've essentially
accept
signed
agreements,
it.
Yeah.
It,
but
yes.
Who reads all that stuff or whatever, right?
No
the
knows.
Lawyers, the people that write it in their favor, right?
But it's even worse than that. Recently, General Mills, for example, if you liked their Facebook page, General Mills, Cheerios, let's say you like it, you're agreeing to an arbitration.
Yeah. No.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so it's that kind of stuff. And also you can sign an agreement on the front end and it not have an arbitration provision. And then they can come back and add it later on and you're still stuck with it as a consumer. So it's one of those things that I don't think on the front end you think anything is ever going to happen. But then when you've actually been injured or fleeced and then you don't have any recourse, you're outraged. But that's really what the consumer arbitration provisions
are. And I have to tell you that I'm very proud of our organization as the Georgia Trial Lawyers, because literally last week, John and I were actually in D.C. meeting with other members of the Georgia Trial Lawyers, with the entire Georgia delegation to the Congress and Senate, about pre-dispute arbitration clauses that are included in contracts for service members. Wow. And there's pending legislation right now that we're lobbying for that would allow service members to be excluded from those arbitration agreements.
Wow.
And I was very happy to also see that we did receive a warm reception from the Georgia delegation. So hopefully we have a chance at addressing that issue.
I wish we had more time. Yeah, I really do. And I think that you guys did a fantastic job representing the Georgia Trial Lawyers Association. And I'm just so glad to have all of these experts here in the room with me.
I agree.
Awesome.
Yeah. There's so many other questions I have, but we are out of time.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll definitely have to have them back.
I agree.
That's for sure. So thank you, everybody, for listening again to Atlanta Legal Experts. This show is sponsored by DaVinci Virtual Offices and DaVinci Meeting Rooms. If you are interested in part-time offices, meeting rooms, or need a professional business address for your business or for a second location in Atlanta, you can find their links on our Atlanta Legal Experts website. That's ALE. .businessradiox.com, ALE.businessradiox.com. Click the DaVinci logo for AL listener specials and promotions, and don't forget to mention AL Radio. This is Emily Rowell with Attorney Office, attorneyofficebase.com, signing out.
That's good service for all these new attorneys you're talking about coming up in the ranks. So we'll see y'all next time.
Thank you.
Thank y'all.
Thank you.